So good afternoon, everyone. This is the question and answer period, but we have to wait about a minute for the questions to come. I haven't seen them yet, which makes me probably more vulnerable than venerable, but what to do? And just in case, you know, we have a whole hour for this, if you do have any questions that come up to you spontaneously, you would like to ask them now, something in relation to what we're talking about, or, you know, after we've gone through the questions and there's still time, then I would say that doesn't really break the silence that you're observing. It's permissible talk. Only thing is that today there seem to be only two questions, and how to fill a half an hour with just two questions. That's my question. Let's see. My biggest problem in meditation is that my legs go numb. Can you suggest ways to prevent this? All right. Mine do too, I must say. And of course, numbness is not a very good thing to keep on having if you sit a lot, suppose every day. Then it's better to have the blood circulation going on. Well, numbness is a sign of less blood circulation to the legs, I suppose. Then when you get up, you have this needles and pins kind of experience. Or you sometimes find it difficult to get up when the legs are very numb. So a slight change of physical posture might be the answer. Or get thyself a, how do you call it, bench? A meditation bench. Here's one. These are actually benches for meditation. No, these are little tables. Yeah, there's one. These are the meditation benches, just small planks put together with a little cushion at a little slope, an angle, where you put your feet underneath and you sort of squat onto them so that there is not much pressure on your calves and you get supported in the back by it. And that may be one solution to overcome the numbness, or get an extra zafu sitting cushion if you find that that is the problem. Sometimes that can also help to get the knees down and the back straightened up and more circulation in your legs. There are different ways. These zafus are actually quite good. If you're not used to sit, that's another factor. If you're not used to sit in these kind of postures, then especially for longer periods or for many times, half an hour, so many times per day, then you do get this problem of numbness in the leg quite often. So this morning, I think it was at the beginning of the guided meditation that I mentioned when you are settling into your posture and you feel that you need to change your posture. I actually noticed quite a few people made use of the occasion to shift around a little bit to adjust their posture. You know, if you do that, but with every uncomfortable feeling, then there's no end to it, actually, because sitting in meditation can be a little bit uncomfortable, especially if you're not used to this. And the technique of dealing with these uncomfortable feelings is that you make it your friend, so to speak. That feeling or that sensation in the legs is not, you know, although it's an uncomfortable feeling, but it should not be giving rise to anger or you know, the feeling that your meditation is being disturbed, but it could become just another object of your mindfulness, and then you could When you do the meditation, especially at home, individually, you're not disturbing anybody by shifting around. But after 2 or 3 or 4 times that you get this feeling, I should change my posture, you could slowly, mindfully change your posture and get rid of that problem. The thing is that is always a temporary solution. After about 5 or 10 minutes, there will be another uncomfortable feeling. And then if you immediately shift again, then your meditation will get disturbed. If you give in to every impulse to change your posture, even if we would have given luxury couches to sit on, or soft chairs, sometimes they become too warm, too soft, and you want to shift. Anyway, that is the nature of our body, especially, and also our mind, reacting to an uncomfortable feeling. But if you can become comfortable with the uncomfortable feeling, accept it as what we call vedana, a feeling or a sensation. It's really not a pleasant feeling, but the unpleasantness increases the more you judge it as uncomfortable. The more you resist it, the more it becomes a problem. So like I mentioned with the pain in the knee, for instance, as an example, I do have sometimes pain in my knees. So to deal with that is to just go into that feeling and see, this is feeling, 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 and not to say, oh, this feeling, I want to get rid of this feeling. Then it becomes not only a pain in the knee, but a pain in the neck also. So, or a headache. And that would help to overcome that pain itself. Sometimes it just disappears when you really accept it. It becomes first a little bit more apparent because you focus on it, and then sometimes the whole strong sensation or that pain may suddenly dissolve, become something like heat, or even some people experience light as a kind of transformation of that pain. So sometimes in longer retreats, and especially of the Goenka type, where they don't practice walking meditation and do more sittings, like 10 hours a day, then it can become quite problematic, and you feel like screaming or, going up the wall or something like that. Even Goenka himself, it seems, when he learned from his teacher, Uba Khin, way back in Burma, he was so experiencing, he said, excruciating pains that he wanted to run away. But he sat through it, and suddenly something happened, and it sort of disappeared. And then it becomes much easier to, especially if you accept that feeling as it is and go into it, sort of embrace it, become one with it, you could call it, not to resist it. Then you can see what happens, and it may just dissolve. So if it still doesn't dissolve, then get the meditation bench, I would say, or a higher cushion. If you sometimes this double is maybe too high and single maybe too low, and there are different sizes also, is it?
Yeah.
Yes, the Zafu is the round one.
Okay, I put it on edge, and I set it kind of on edge, and so that helped. Well, this particular Zafu is made out of buckwheat, and it's a good staple. Others are, I believe it's called K-Pak, and so I have to experiment to see which one is good.
Yes, buckwheat, the chaff of buckwheat seeds, I think, is what is put in there. And the Japanese actually use that in the Zen monasteries. It's very sort of malleable to your body, but it is also quite stable. And it is also not heaty. with certain kind of cushions, if you have like other kind of materials, but cotton or kapok is something very good, but any kind of artificial materials tend to get heaty. And then, as you said, when you sit at the edge, then also it doesn't cut off the artery here in the back of your thigh. So that could be one reason that your legs don't get quite enough blood circulation, and then they start feeling a bit numb. But yet another way, what I have found is, if you really pay attention to that part of the body and you look at those sensations, somehow or other, the blood circulation gets back to normal also. Just sending energy or attention into that area also can help.
Yeah, if I may add, Pante,
yes.
Do they have what you call collateral circulation? Like for the blood vessels returning to the heart, they might be a mistake, but I believe they form more and you get more varicose veins. A lot of varicose veins and you have to get over the thing.
To increase the varicose veins is the solution?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Oh, then I should sit them.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. Any doctors in the hall? You're a doctor? What would you say about this solution?
I would say you wouldn't want to create varicose veins.
Oh, okay.
Yes. So extra veins or arteries sort of tend to form. Uh-huh. Yes. Yeah. But I think, you know, to go the middle way, to have not too long of sittings, like 40 minutes, I would say, of sitting and 20 minutes of walking, is quite a good solution. In some meditation centers, like where I started in Sri Lanka, way back in 1975, it was 1 hour of walking and half an hour of 1 hour of sitting and half an hour of walking meditation. So at least to alternate the sitting and the walking, that would help also with the circulation, I think. If you just sit and sit and sit and sit, it would not be such a good idea, I think, in the long run for the legs. But don't fear that your leg is going to fall off, I would say to the person, and try one of these tips to overcome that experience that it is a problem. It may be already half solved now. Then, what is the reason or significance of the bowl chime at the beginning and the end of the meditation? That is this bowl, I suppose. It's not exactly regarding the meditation, but, indirectly, of course, the beginning and the end of the meditation. Very often they will use these. Now this one, I'm not sure if it's a Japanese one or a Chinese one, but in China, Japan, Vietnam, Korea, all these Mahayana countries especially, they have this kind of bowl type of chime, gong, on one side of the altar, usually on that side, and a wooden fish that is a hollowed out piece of wood with looking like a fish kind of thing. And that has a kind of hammer, a thing to beat it, and something like this, similar to this, and this also. It gives, it's usually used at the beginning and during the chanting ceremonies of Mahayana Buddhist temples, where there are two monks or two nuns, if it's a nunnery, then who play these instruments. They're actually like Buddhist instruments for ritual purposes. And they can vary from very small to very large, like this size. And that is boom, very, very, very powerful sound. with a very big stick which they hit. You need a strong person to sort of hit that ball, and it is done in a very special way. You sort of wake up the ball and then hit it. And in the case of chanting, especially in the Chinese language, you know, there is what is called monosyllabic, monosyllables. There is a ching chang chong ping pang pong type of language. No, I speak a bit of Chinese, but this was my own sort of version of how it sounds at the beginning. Every single syllable is one word. So when they chant, it is ching chang chong chung pung pang tun tun. And they keep the rhythm with the wooden fish, and at certain sentences, they go like boom, and then towards the end also. I'm sort of beating around the bush a little bit here for the question that was asked about the significance of the ball at the beginning, at the end of the meditation session. But this is, I think, where it came from, and the ball to indicate the beginning of a meditation, well, in the first place, these are very good sounding balls. They are a kind of a combination of five metals, sometimes seven metals, and they sound for a long time. So it helps you to sort of increase your mindfulness or your concentration. If you listen to the ball, then you listen to it till the end, it's quite a long span of attention that you have. So both to get into the meditation as well as out of the meditation, I would say this is quite a good way of starting and ending the session. And also rather than just saying, let us now start and this is it or something like that, as a beginning and an ending, a good sounding beginning and a good sounding ending of the meditation. So it has various meanings. I don't know if there's any other person in the hall who has any other founded opinion about or where it exactly came from, but this is about what I have understood. In the tradition of Thich Nhat Hanh, the Zen master from Vietnam who lives in France, but who travels around the world, and who is now also in his 80s, like Bante Ji, he uses the wooden fish, a small wooden fish, to indicate during walking meditation a time to stop with one beat, and then two beats to start walking again, to increase the mindfulness. Sometimes when you're walking and you're practicing walking meditation, it's just becoming a bit mechanical and you lose your mindfulness. And then with the one beat, come to a standing position, become aware of standing again, and then tok tok, start again. And it helps to increase the mindfulness. That is, especially in his tradition, I've seen it. I don't know in any other traditions. In the Zen section of a big monastery in Taiwan, where I did a 1 week Chan Chi, they call it. Chan is kind of the Chinese word for Zen. And this 1 week Zen retreat, they used actually the Zen stick as a way, not by hitting people, but by hitting the floor, the wooden floor, to indicate. And they also had other kind of instruments, a big bell and a gong also to indicate, and a ting kind of instrument, what they call the ting, a small bell on a stick with a metal piece that sounds it. So there's different kinds of schools, different traditions who use similar instruments for the beginning, sometimes the middle and the re-beginning and the end of the meditation.
Distraction, and Is it helpful to have, I think it's called a metronome? Is it like a, usually a triangular instrument on top of a piano? And you can set it for 1 second, click.
Well, it has a whole scale for the different rhythms. A metronome is like a tick-tock, tick-tock kind of instrument. You could set it for the different rhythms or for the different speed of the rhythm of that particular piece. I used to be a piano player, and we had a metronome. And but now you've got electronic metronomes in kind of, New Age bookshops, for instance. You can buy them. But the tick-tock type of, I'm not sure whether that is a good idea, but there's yet another thing, that is the mindfulness bell. You can actually download the mindfulness bell to your computer. You know, it's also coming, I think, from Thich Nhat Hanh's tradition, from their Sangha, and it can be downloaded, and then you can set it in different ways, like on the hour, or every half an hour, or randomly. So then, and you can set different chimes also. They have this kind of sound, or bigger sound, or the Big Ben kind of sound. If it is every hour, like he says, Thich Nhat Hanh says, just to remind yourself to be mindful again, come to the present moment. Like if you have a hectic kind of job, and you sometimes forget about yourself or to be mindful, just bing, and just take a little time for yourself to get back into that present moment. When it comes once an hour, well, then it's once an hour, or once in half an hour if you need that. And of course the surprise element is there if you set it on random. It may ring anytime and catch you unawares sometimes. Yeah. But that is all actually different ways of increasing the mindfulness. But I don't know the effect of a metronome, which is the same tick-tack, tick-tack. I feel that it might start working hypnotically, actually, if you do like that. And it would also probably, well, you could get used to it, I suppose, but sounds are, in a way, number one enemy of tranquility meditation, they say. Now, if it's a very regular sound like the metronome, then it may even help to increase your meditation. I'm not sure. I've never tried it. But unexpected sounds, like that of a carpenter next door who is hammering, you know, like it happens sometimes, especially at times that one has group meditation in Sri Lanka, next door neighbor will hammer something, and then that is an unexpected sound. It's not a pleasant sound also, usually, generally speaking. So that is, if you are practicing Samatha Bhavana or tranquility meditation, a kind of enemy. It distracts you, it disturbs the meditation. But if you practice just mindfulness and letting go immediately, and it's just another sound, another object for that moment, and no more. But most people try to get into the tranquility, and then they find that this sound sort of disturbs them. But there has been some experimentation done on Zen masters, how they get distracted by sounds. Now, for instance, a normal person, when there is a regular sound, like a banging of a hammer, but it is regular, you get used to it. And after some time, you sort of don't notice it. But the Zen master, his graph goes up every time, the same. He never gets used to it. Sometimes, but he doesn't carry it. He's not like angry about it. It just goes like a jumping graph every time, strangely enough. But he doesn't get, never gets used to it. His mind is always fresh, it seems.
Well, that may be a sign of pretty advanced meditation.
Yes, could be. Yeah. It's meant to be as an example for an advanced meditator that it is going up and down like a, it's a little bit like a shock. The, just in the mind itself, probably something happens. And if you have maybe with electrodes on the brain or some kind of skin resistance measure, like biofeedback, something happens there. So normal people get used to it. You are raising your hand to ask something? Yes, please.
Can you explain a little bit about the relationship between tranquility meditation and Vipassana meditation? Should you practice one before the other?
That's a very good question, actually. Thank you for that. It is well said in different ways by different people. You know that the need for tranquility meditation, or whether we should first practice tranquility meditation and then vipassana. You have schools of Buddhist meditation which are called samatha vipassana, so that is tranquility and then insight meditation. So they go through a process of increasing their tranquility or power of concentration on one chosen object and get absorbed in that and develop maybe some level of jhanas. There are what is called the jhanas. There are different descriptions of it. But it does mean that if you look at your mind as a series of moments of consciousness, and now, for instance, we have seeing and hearing and feeling going on. There are six senses going on at the same time. But when you concentrate on something, one of those six senses will be emphasized and will take more of those moments of consciousness. So if you concentrate more and more on one object and you exclude other objects, then maybe two-thirds or three-quarters of that mind moment, which is filled with many, many mind moments or moments of consciousness, will be filled with that particular sense. So in that way, when you concentrate on something, it is like you're getting absorbed in that, and that will lead to certain psychic powers sometimes. That is the general outcome of tranquility meditation. It doesn't only give tranquility, but if you get into the deeper levels of the jhanas, then especially if you reach the fourth jhana, which is characterized by just mindfulness and equanimity, first you go through different stages of applied, what is called attention, then sustained attention, and you get some kind of, when you get there, a feeling of happiness and zest and feeling of well-being, at ease, and then you sort of transcend those stages and it becomes equanimity and mindfulness. That is like the fourth jhana. If you get there through the path of tranquility meditation, through exclusive concentration on an object, then they say you can develop what is called psychic powers in the sense of clairvoyance, clairaudience, thought reading, remembering past lives, and sometimes bilocation, to be in two places, which could be useful if I have interviews and this at the same time. So that is one way. That would be like, not a final solution to the problem of suffering in samsara. It is a temporary thing, and these are byproducts of the tranquility meditation. So if you first develop that, sometimes people get stuck in that because it's very interesting and, you know, the psychic powers are very fascinating and they get carried away sometimes by them before purifying their mind, getting it free from greed, hatred and jealousy and things like that, and then get lost in that kind of tranquility. So one has to know what one is doing, actually. According to the Buddha's teachings, if you do the samatha bhavana, you should do it under a good teacher who has already overcome those kind of obstacles and who is able to advise you on how to get further if you get stuck somewhere by one or the other psychic power and don't know what to do with it. So, therefore, there are other schools which say, well, the one school says you go through that and then you get into vipassana. So then you have samatha vipassana. And I think the bhikkhuni who is here from Burma, She is a disciple of Pa Auxaido.
I believe so.
Yes, I think so, what I heard. And Pa Auxaido is somebody who is into the Samatha Vipassana school of Vipassana meditation. They do, yeah, and also Abhidharma, knowledge of the states of mind, the higher psychology of Buddhism. They study it, but then they also watch it in their meditation practice. Different states of mind, very finely defined by the Buddha, 154 different states of mind. Very refined kind of psychology, you could say. But that school also goes into deeper levels of samatha meditation and then on to the vipassana. But as I mentioned earlier, most people don't have that kind of time or place of tranquility to practice, because a lot of people live in noisy environments or they're very busy. They have so many things to do, so many experiences during the day, and a lot of things to come up. Sometimes multitasking, and then suddenly if you sit down, you can't expect your mind to get into that very deep level of tranquility. You really need a long retreat for that, and under the guidance of a good samatha teacher, and there are not that many in the world, I would say. So that would be a little difficult path. And then there are the people who say, and that is also, you know, corroborated by the 5th century commentator, Buddhaghosa, who has written a big book on, it's a manual for meditation, it's called The Path of Purification, the Visuddhimagga. He has said there are possibilities of not getting into even the first jhana, but slightly before that is called excess concentration, just close to the deeper concentration. That goes together with a phenomenon that is like you start seeing a kind of a dot of light or a disc or something in your third eye, and sometimes with bright fluorescent colors of greenish, bluish, pinkish or gold. That kind of phenomenon. Different, what they call counter signs, which show that you're getting into that level of concentration, but not yet reached the first jhana. And he says, and a lot of followers of his say, that that is already enough for us to get insight into what is called the three characteristics of existence. Now we're going a little bit into topics that would have been dealt with later on, but why not? You know, the three characteristics of existence are those that we tend to see in vipassana meditation. Vipassana means that insight into the impermanence of all conditioned things, the unsatisfactoriness of all conditioned things, and the non-self nature, or the insubstantiality of all conditioned things. Those are things that we don't like to see normally. We like to have permanency, we like to have pleasure, and we like to have ourself and maybe live forever. But the facts are that it is not so. So to see that through insight can be a discovery, and that is one of the things that happens in the Vipassana meditation. So if you follow the school of Samatha Vipassana, you can get those insights if you use your mindfulness, because insight comes through mindfulness, not through just tranquility. If you stop at tranquility, you cannot get that, unless you also add the mindfulness factor. So based on tranquility, you can have plus mindfulness, deep levels of insight. And sometimes they say, yes, you need that in order to have the real insight. But the others say it is the school of what is called the dry school of insight, dry vipassana or sukha vipassana. That says the excess concentration is enough. In that way you can also see these three characteristics which help you to uproot your greed, hatred and delusion. And if that is uprooted, then you're a free person. So one is called Samatha Vidarshana or Samatha Vipassana. Vidarshana would be Bengali and Sanskrit. You're Bengali, no? Did I get it right?
Part.
Okay, part Bengali. And that Vidarshana is like the Sanskrit and the Hindi form and also the Sinhalese form of the word. Vipassana is the Pali word. So Samatha Vipassana is tranquility, insight, combination of the practice, and dry Vipassana would be without the deep levels of tranquility. And I think that is more or less the path that I'm taking. Because it is a bit impractical and almost unfair to the practitioners, I would say, you know, because you can't always have that long of a retreat, that kind of luxury to be away from everything. So there is the dry Vipassana. And maybe it's dry, so I'll have a little bit of water. And the other thing is that tranquility, not of that enforced, you know, concentration that we get if you focus on one thing for a longer, longer, longer time and get absorbed in it, but tranquility also can come when you let things come and go and don't attach to this, don't have an aversion to that, don't get involved in any of it. Then you can experience a kind of tranquility which is not enforced, not a result of exclusive meditation, concentration on an object. Yes, James or Jim. Yes. I think I can. Yes, well, it is said that it is a good idea to be able to wish yourself to be well, peaceful and happy before you can actually wish it to other people. If you cannot really wish it to yourself, and if you're not really well and happy, then it is difficult to share that positive vibration with other people. Now, some people might, you know, why should I be well and happy? And we could say, why not? It's your birthright, basically, that you should be well and happy. But we are so complicated, sometimes life is so difficult that we forget about ourselves also sometimes, that we also need to be well and happy. It could be either out of too much altruism, just doing things for other people and forgetting about yourself. That's not a bad quality in itself. But also people who cannot really wish themselves to be well and happy, a sort of self-hatred. And then it's a good idea to try and overcome these negative thoughts and feelings or attitudes towards yourself and really say, why not? Why shouldn't I be well and happy? And then to, develop it to yourself because of the reasons I just mentioned. You cannot really develop it towards other people if you cannot develop it towards yourself. So that's why we actually, in every practice in the Metta meditation, we start with ourselves. Not as a kind of selfishness, but basically that is where it starts. Change the world, begin with yourself, that kind of a thing. So if you can really wish yourself to be well, peaceful and happy, well, most people, I would say, have not a big problem with that. But some do. Then you have to first work on that one that you really feel, yes, I also want to be well, peaceful and happy, and I really wish it to be. And then also get that kind of peace and happiness within, and then start sharing it with others. I think the son of Stephen Levine, what is his name? Noah Levine. Noah Levine is a meditation teacher now in his own right. His father, Stephen Levine, is of that group of Jack Kornfield, I think, in Spirit Rock in California. And yes, Stephen Levine used to teach there as well. And Noah was kind of, punk and drug addict for some time, and he was quite a problematic kind of person. But he also became a meditation teacher, and I've once heard him do a guided metta meditation, and he's so honest, you know, that may all beings be well and happy. But not that particular guy, you know, or something like that. That it just mentioned what came up to in his own mind, like what may be actually also sometimes a reality, that you really have a dislike for somebody and you just can't get over it. But then, of course, they say, if you manage to first have loving kindness towards yourself, then towards somebody whom you respect, that's not so difficult, then a neutral person, and then a person with whom you have issues or difficulties, a problem, or even your enemy. And if you can gradually build up that loving kindness towards all these categories, and then finally even towards your enemy, then you have overcome that anger and hatred, maybe forgiveness and loving kindness also in the same vein. I think if you go to Noah Levine, Levine, I think, on YouTube, you might find some of his talks quite interesting. Are there any other kind of questions at the moment? Yes, please. Sleepiness during the meditation.
Yeah, probably because the quality of sleep is not good to begin with, but how do I recognize the feeling and notice it, you know, before it overcomes and start
nodding off.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I can give you some traditional techniques to overcome it. One is to slightly open your eyes, to have a little bit of light coming into your eyes. Not to look out in the distance, although one technique is also to look up in the sky, a clear sky, that would sort of wake you up. It's maybe something like the principle of a photovoltaic cell, you know, in a calculator, that when you open the thing, it starts to work. Maybe your brain also reacts to that if you get a bit of light. And sometimes the sleepiness goes together with daydreaming also, no? So when you open your eyes slightly, just to have enough contact with your immediate surroundings, then you're back in contact with something that's really there, and the tendency of daydreaming may be then reduced, and you get this little visual energy also, and that may wake you up. There are different kind of techniques also. First of all, sometimes if you can just become aware of it, but you know the characteristic of sleepiness is a lack of awareness. So you sort of how to get out of it if you feel you're stuck in that place, then this would be one way of overcoming it. Another way is to pull your earlobes. Now that is, if you're sitting like this, quite a distance, but if you pull your earlobes, it has something to do with acupressure, then you stimulate some energy which wakes you up. Now there is yet another one where you can keep your hands like this and have the nails of, let's say, your thumb and your middle finger touch two sides of your nail bed at the bottom where that little moon shape is, at the base of your nail, any finger, if you really press a little bit hard, sort of pressing you can feel a little painful feeling on that side. Any finger really has that. And that also stimulates your energy. So you could be sitting here and waking yourself up, just a few fingers, one by the other, or maybe even just one finger if it works. So then they say another way would be, if that doesn't help, do some walking meditation. If you are at home and you feel that you feel sleepy when you're sitting, then walking meditation could help. Because it's, unless you're an expert in what is called dream walking or sleep walking, then you know, normally you don't fall asleep while you're walking. So that, if you feel now it's enough, and then you can sit down again, maybe you're energized like that. And then a more drastic way is to have some ice water or cold water and splash it into your face, or wash your face with cold water. But of course, if we would provide you with bowls with cold water, and then no, I don't think it's a good idea in the meditation hall. But that is, of course, anybody knows that if you wash your face, you feel a little bit more refreshed. And then if you're still sleepy, then it is better to take a nap, I suppose.
If I may add something, some years ago I was meditating with a fellow from Louisiana, and I was meditating and I hear something squeaking. And it paused, you know, and I hear, and he was squeaking. And then I realized he had been given some advice from Bhante Ji. He says that, as a lead-in to this, is that you, under these circumstances, you do manipulate the breath, and so you have more vigorous inhalations, and then exhalations, and so that and more intense inhalations can help arouse you. But if that doesn't work, you can draw in a big lung full of air and hold your breath. And if you hold your breath long enough, you'll actually start to perspire. And then you're awake.
Yes. It oxygenizes your blood also. You get more oxygen through the lungs, into the blood, and then to the brain also. Yes, that I forgot to mention. That is another way. Deeper breathing, because we usually do just natural breathing. Maybe at the beginning I say take a couple of deep breaths if you don't feel the breath. But that is another thing. You can also do that when you have lost the breath. And in this case, even when you feel that you're drowsy, then a couple of deep breaths, and then in this case holding the breath is a little bit more rigorous. Take it, you know, first exhale till your lungs are empty, then a deep breath and hold the breath, and again, not too many times, that could make you dizzy also, but a couple of deep breaths will help to oxygenize your blood and you feel more refreshed. Well, if there are no more questions, are there? Doesn't look like. Then I think I will slowly work my way.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.